From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, we take a deep dive into the crisis caused by the Trump administration and its zero-tolerance policy.
The baby is brought up in front of the judge. He kind of looked at him and said, you know, I'm embarrassed to even ask this. Can a one-year-old learn immigration law?
Some of the families torn apart have little sense of when or whether they'll be reunited with their children.
The emotional impact of her seeing her husband kind of walk out of those doors of the airbase without her daughter. She later said, what if I lose my daughter forever?
And we meet Juan Sanchez, the CEO of the largest organization sheltering migrant children without their parents.
We're not holding these kids. We're serving these kids in a way that's getting them ready to be reunited with their families.
That's coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No te vayas. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Last April, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced the government's new zero-tolerance policy at the border.
People are not going to caravan or otherwise stampede our border. I have put in place a zero-tolerance policy for illegal entry on our southwest border.
This included the criminal prosecution of all adults who crossed the border illegally. And if they had their children with them, they couldn't be detained together, so that meant they would be separated.
We had been looking for examples of young children who had been separated from their families, and we thought a good place to go would be immigration court.
Astrid Galvan has been covering the impact of the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy for the Associated Press.
I showed up to court, sat down on the wooden bench, and the first thing I noticed was these two little kids kind of in the middle row with their feet hanging from the wooden bench. And a short while later, this little baby comes in. And I thought, wow, he looks really small. He didn't look much bigger than my baby, who's 8 months old. So I thought, you know, he was under a year.
The baby had been taken from his father after being detained while crossing the border together. The father was eventually deported back to Honduras. And here was this baby standing trial in front of an immigration judge without his parents.
And he had this bottle with his name labeled onto it. His name is Joan. He was really calm. He was playing with this little purple ball that he would throw on the floor and it would light up different colors.
According to immigration law, all unaccompanied minors must appear in front of a judge, regardless of their age. So this judge had to determine whether or not baby Johan would stay in the custody of the U.S. government or be sent back to be reunited with his parents in Honduras. As part of his job, the judge had to ask whether the defendant understood the court proceedings.
So the baby is brought up in front of the judge. He kind of looked at him and said, you know, I'm embarrassed to even ask this. Can a one-year-old learn immigration law? But, you know, this is where we are. This is the case before me.
This happened back in July. Just a week prior, national outcry had led a federal judge in California to order U.S. immigration authorities to reunite all parents and their children below the age of five by July 10th.
The judge asked the ICE attorney, hey, are these kids going to be reunited with their parents by the deadline? And the attorney said he didn't know.
The judge ended up granting him what's called a voluntary departure order. While ICE missed the deadline to reunite him by over a week, he was eventually flown back to his parents. And Astrid, the AP reporter who's been covering immigration for several years now, said that as she watched the proceedings, she couldn't really believe what she was seeing.
I have never seen anything like this or even remotely close to something like this.
There have been a lot of changes to immigration policy since President Trump took office. But nothing has been quite as controversial as the decision to make a policy of separating migrant parents from their children. Today, we'll be dedicating our show to looking at the aftermath of the administration's zero-tolerance policy. Who continues to be affected, and what lessons, if any, have been learned? Later in our show, the story of Juan Sanchez, the CEO of Southwest Key Programs. It's the largest nonprofit sheltering migrant children torn apart from their families. And we explore the profound dilemma he faces as he grapples with the moral implications of his work and how he balances this with his Latino identity. But first, what happens to the hundreds of kids who can't be reunited with their families because their parents have already been deported?
A federal judge in California ruled overnight, more overnight news, that the Trump administration must reunite separated immigrant families within 30 days. The order after
the government's deadline to reunite all the children torn apart as part of the zero tolerance policy with their families was July 26th. After the deadline was announced, immigration authorities scrambled to find parents and reunite families. And all over the country, immigrant parents were crying and hugging their children as they met them at bus terminals and airports. This included 30-year-old Morena Mendoza from El Salvador, who hadn't seen her 12-year-old son, Osmar, for almost 3 months.
Morena, le mandan saludos a las de otros países y otros continentes.
After getting bailed out of detention by an advocacy group called Mi Gente, Morena got a phone call from her son's social worker. 2 days later, she was on her way to the Miami airport to be finally reunited with her son.
Esta es nuestra lucha.
Morena and her son finally embrace each other in silence, but tightly. And after she breaks down, 12-year-old Osmar begins to console his own mother. On the way out, Morena and her son held hands, and while driving to their temporary Miami home, Osmar asked if they could stop to buy Spanish limes from a guy selling them on the side of the road. It was a small taste of the home that he and his mom had left behind. Morena's asylum case is still pending, and while she waits to hear, at least she'll be able to be with her son. But not all families have been as fortunate as Morena and Osmar. After the deadline passed, the government claimed to have reunited all of the separated kids in time. However, of the more than 2,500 kids torn away from their parents, the reality is that more than 700 children are still in U.S. custody. In an unprecedented move, the U.S. government has deemed these children ineligible for reunification. In some cases, they cite parents' criminal records, but lawyers say their definition of criminality is overly broad. In other cases, they say they've lost track of the parents, this after deporting them without their children. Latino USA producer Andres Caballero takes us into one of those stories.
After hearing about cases where parents who had been separated from their kids were already being deported without them, Patrick McDonald, the bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times in Mexico City, decided to get on a plane to Guatemala.
And I knew that at the Air Force base in Guatemala City, every day several plane loads of deportees were arriving. My thought was, well, if I waited at this air base, I might find a parent who had been separated from their children upon their arrest in the States and then deported.
When Patrick arrived to the airbase, he saw many families waiting outside for their loved ones. He said that morning, at least 4 plane loads of people had come in.
The last of the 4 planes came through. We found a family outside, very emotional, very distraught, particularly the mother. Her name was Claudia Gonzalez, and they told me the story.
Claudia was waiting for her husband, Ovidio Batres Morales, who was deported after being detained for crossing into the U.S. illegally with their 7-year-old daughter, Ashley. Claudia and Ovidio had broken up and were no longer living together, but she still went to the airport to find him and demand answers about their daughter. Claudia said she was indecisive on whether or not to let Ashley make the trip to the U.S. with her dad. She had heard that families were being separated at the border, but she thought it would just be for a little while, and then they'd be reunited. She even made sure to sign a document giving Ovidio full custody of Ashley in case anything went wrong. She said that with a difficult financial situation at home, she thought Ashley could at least go to a better school, maybe one day become the doctor she pretended to be whenever she noticed her mom feeling sick. She recalled saying bye to Ashley before she left to the U.S. with her dad. She told her daughter she was allowing her to go on the journey, but that she would be taking a piece of mom's heart with her. She told her she wasn't giving her away, that she still loved her, but that she simply wanted a better future for her.
The emotional impact of her seeing her husband kind of walk out of those doors of the airbase without her daughter, I mean, it was really kind of overwhelming for Claudia. And she later said, what if I lose my daughter forever? And she was hysterical in tears, which was a contrast to her husband, who was very sullen and withdrawn and completely looked like a broken man. He kept saying, I never thought they would take my daughter away.
Weeks after Ovidio was deported to Guatemala, we hired a local reporter to go visit him at the house where he once lived with Ashley, in Monteverde, a small town in the south. Ovidio lives in a two-room adobe house. A small river flows at the foot of the hill beneath where the house sits. Ovidio is a soft-spoken man. He still carries the trauma of walking for days and being caught by Border Patrol in Texas. He says the most difficult part after crossing the border was being separated from Ashley. They then put him in a hielera, the infamous air-conditioned room known as the icebox. He says he didn't sleep. All he could think about was his daughter. Ovidio was then taken to an El Paso detention center. And about 7 weeks later, they told him he had no chance of staying in the U.S. He says he asked the officers if he could talk to Ashley, but they told him they had no idea where she was. And then he says they would take him into a room every day and ask him to sign some papers. He can't read or write. He says he can't speak English, and he says no Spanish translator was provided for him. He refused to sign. He kept telling them he didn't want to sign, that he didn't want to be deported without his daughter. He says the officers assured him that he was not signing his deportation.
Coming up on Latino USA, what happens to Ashley's father, Ovidio? Stay with us, no te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Annenberg Foundation, committed to supporting, educating, and engaging communities in the United States and globally for more than 25 years. Learn more at annenbergfoundation.org. And the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide to address inequality in all its forms. Learn more at fordfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and we continue now with the story of Ovidio, a Guatemalan migrant who crossed into the United States with his daughter, Ashley. After they were separated, Ovidio was put into detention, where he says ICE officers were pressuring him to sign papers that he didn't understand. Producer Andres Caballero picks up the story.
Ovidio says there were two officers who were particularly intimidating. They kept telling him to sign over and over again, until eventually he did. Ovidio doesn't know exactly what he signed. And advocates and attorneys say it's hard to know because the government hasn't provided any copies of documents signed by immigrants. But ultimately, whatever it was that he signed, Ovidio unwittingly relinquished his right to reunite with Ashley. The government said that of the nearly 400 cases where parents were deported, in over 100 of them, immigrants actually waived the right to reunite with their kids. Megan Fino Velasquez is the co-founder and director of the Center on Immigration and Child Welfare, an advocacy group.
And now their lawyers are questioning the legality of these orders because they're hearing that their clients didn't understand what they were signing or that they signed something under pressure. For example, if they're distressed over not knowing where their children are, and they're being led to believe that this voluntary deportation is the only way to be reunited with their kids.
I reached out to ICE for comment about parents who may have unwittingly signed voluntary deportation forms. They did not respond. The American Civil Liberties Union recently filed several affidavits in court stating that many of the parents did not know what they had signed when they gave up their right to be reunited with their kids. While in detention, Ovidio called his brother for help, Ashley's uncle, who lives in Maryland. The uncle sent $500 to a lawyer he found in Texas, but he never heard from him again.
Hello?
Hello.
When I called the uncle, he seemed confused and overwhelmed by all of the government paperwork. He said he didn't know if or when they would let Ashley stay with him. None of her family members seem to know for sure where she is, but they think she's in a shelter somewhere in Arizona. Ashley's caseworker did not reply to several calls. The phone number has a Phoenix area code. When a minor's parents are deported, finding a relative in the U.S. who's fit to care for the kid is always an option. But the process can still be confusing and difficult to navigate, especially without the help of a lawyer. And if you're undocumented, it could be even harder, because coming forward means sharing your information with the government. From her shelter, thousands of miles away from her parents, Ashley asked her social worker to call her dad. Ovidio recalls Ashley crying and telling him she wanted to get out of the shelter. She kept saying she wanted to go with her uncle or back to Guatemala with her dad. Ashley's parents hope she'll be allowed to stay with her uncle. That way, everything they went through won't have been in vain. Here's Ashley's mom, Claudia, again.
Es bien difícil porque no pensando lo que le fuera a pasar, ese encierro que tiene allá, pues sí. Tantas cosas que me han contado.
Claudia says it's hard to imagine what could happen to Ashley being out there in that shelter, that she'd heard horrible things. And one day, Ashley's social worker called. She told Claudia that Ashley was acting up. When Claudia finally spoke to Ashley, she said she had had enough, that she was sick of being there. Right now, Ashley remains among the over 400 kids with deported parents who are still floating in the government system. And if her uncle doesn't end up getting the custody, there are a few things that could happen. A judge could order her to be flown to Guatemala and reunite with her parents, which can be a difficult process that could take months. Or, if she stays in the U.S., she could end up in the foster care system. But Ashley isn't the only kid in limbo. Advocates and attorneys say that the government had no clear plan on how to reunite parents with their children. The zero tolerance policy is now essentially defunct. But even if the government succeeds at reuniting the rest of the children, experts are now worried about the policy's lasting psychological impact on kids like Ashley.
What's her future now? Is she going to go back to Monteverde?
That's Patrick, the LA Times reporter you heard from earlier.
And what lasting impact will this have on this girl of 7 years old? I mean, I think those are kind of imponderables, but I mean, those are some of the questions I'm left with.
It's been about 3 weeks since the judge's reunification deadline passed, and over 500 children are still away from their parents. Like Ashley, about half of them are from Guatemala. Earlier this month, the federal government squared off with the ACLU in district court and tried to argue that the ACLU should take over the responsibility of reuniting these remaining children. But Judge Dana Sabra responded that the U.S. government is 100% responsible for failing to reunite these children in time. And it's up to them to finish the task.
Our thanks to producer Andres Caballero for that story. Joining me in the studio is Latino USA producer Antonia Cerejido.
Hi, Maria.
So, Antonia, we've been talking about one person for a while now. His name is Juan Sanchez.
Yes, and I remember the day that you and I both heard about him. It was that day that Senator Jeff Merkley from Oregon flew to Texas to see what was happening at a shelter on the border where he heard that children who had been separated in the zero tolerance policy were being held.
Senator Jeff Merkley is a Democrat from Oregon, but he spent his Sunday in Texas. While he was there, he spent some of that time getting written up by police in the parking lot of what used to be a Walmart supercenter.
The Walmart supercenter had been converted into a migrant shelter.
Right, and there are cameras that showed up. It became a big scene. And then the police were called on the senator.
What was your name again? I'm sorry, Senator?
Senator Jeff Merkley. Jeff, U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley.
Yeah, and then the senator was turned away from the shelter. And that moment, it became sort of like emblematic.
It was emblematic of this feeling like, wait, what is going on? What's happening? There are secrets being kept, places we can't get into. It was all very kind of murky.
So in that footage, Senator Merkley asks a staff member at the shelter for the name of her supervisor.
Yes, what is his name?
His name is Juan Sanchez.
Juan Sanchez?
And that's how we first hear of Juan Sanchez. As it turns out, Juan Sanchez is not just this woman's supervisor. He's the CEO of Southwest Key Programs, which is a nonprofit organization that reportedly holds the largest contract with the government to house these migrant kids.
Southwest Key runs Casa Padre, the shelter Senator Merkley was denied access to, along with 26 other shelters for migrant children spread across Texas, Arizona, and California.
After the Merkley incident, Southwest Key immediately came under fire. One headline read, "Meet the couple who facilitated Trump's order to snatch kids from parents," in reference to Juan and his wife, who also works at Southwest Key. Another headline said, "A Latino nonprofit is holding separated kids. Is that care or complicity or both?" Most recently, Southwest Key has been under fire for allegations of abuse in its shelters, which we'll get to later.
Yet, if you look on Southwest Key's website, you're going to find a different narrative. There, it says that Juan has served on the board of several important organizations, including the National Council of La Raza, which is now known as Unidos U.S. It's one of the most prominent Latino advocacy groups in the country. Juan Sanchez has also won multiple social justice awards, including awards specifically for his work on behalf of immigrant children.
When you and I first read this bio several months back in June, it felt jarring. The description seemed the opposite of what was being said about Sanchez in the press. He was being portrayed as this, like, evil guy who was holding children who were forced from the arms of their parents in child detention. But his official bio portrayed him as this Latino social justice champion.
Right, so which one is it? I mean, it's confusing, right? And we were immediately intrigued.
Yeah, so I reached out to Southwest Key Programs to see if Juan would sit down for an interview with you.
Yes.
Thank you so much for speaking with me on Latino USA. We appreciate it.
No, it's a pleasure to talk to you, Maria.
We ended up doing multiple interviews with Juan Sanchez. The first one was back in June, back when everywhere you looked, family separation and the zero tolerance policy was in the headlines. Juan went to a local station in Austin, and I spoke to him from our studios in Harlem.
We get requests for a lot of interviews, and I have really just not done very many because you understand. But there's a few that I select to do, and this is one of them. So thank you for inviting me.
Why did you say yes to our interview?
Because you're Latina, and because it's Latino USA, and that means a lot to me.
And why does it mean a lot to you?
Because I'm a Latino, and we have been, fighting for Latino causes all my life.
Juan grew up in Brownsville, Texas, right on the border with Mexico.
There were nothing but Latinos for blocks and blocks and blocks, so you never even knew that other people outside of Latinos existed. Right?
Juan says his father was a custodian for a rail line, and his mother was a stay-at-home mom that raised him and his six siblings. He has memories of walking to school with his siblings and neighbors.
And everybody had dreams about what they wanted to be when they grew up. Eventually, when we became teenagers, some of my friends began to get arrested. What I noticed when they came back home is that brightness in their eyes and that spirit of my dreams and what I want to be when I grow up, there was no longer there. So I said to myself, when I grow up, I want to do something to help my friends.
When he was a teenager, Juan says that he actually wanted to become a probation officer. He says those were some of the only people that he saw trying to help his friends stay on track in life. He eventually grew out of that idea when he went to college and went to Harvard for his doctoral degree in education. What was your dissertation on?
My dissertation was on Chicano alternative schools in the Southwest.
Juan was interested in juvenile justice work. He founded Southwest Key with the idea of creating alternatives to incarceration and detention for young people. As part of the program, he created a group home in Texas for at-risk youth.
Later on, though, Juan got a contract to start working with unaccompanied minors. Those are teens and children who arrive at the border by themselves. That part of your program, when did that develop?
About 20 years ago.
Does somebody pick up the phone? You get a phone call? What was going on?
It's interesting that, there was a revolution going on in El Salvador. And so there were thousands of people coming into Brownsville. And of course, Brownsville is my area, and we were doing work down there with juvenile justice.
That's when Juan opened his first shelter for migrant youth. And since then, Southwest Key's shelter operations have expanded a lot. They now have 27 shelters and over 7,000 workers. At this point, I had a lot of other questions, but I decided to ask them in person since Juan had told me that there was a possibility of touring one of his shelters. I'd love to know if, one, I can meet you in person, and two, if you would actually, if you would be my escort into one of your facilities.
Yeah, we'd love to do that. Wherever you want to go, Maria, we'll make accommodations for you. The only thing we have to do is, of course, we have to get permission from the Office of Refugee Resettlement to make sure that you're allowed to go in, but we're always making requests. Some people they say yes to, and some people they say no to, so I don't know, it depends on your popularity. They might tell you no.
Really?
No, I don't think so.
Juan made it sound like it was going to be easy to visit the shelters he runs, but that did not end up being the case.
ORR is the Office of Refugee Resettlement, and it's the government department that oversees unaccompanied minors. And Antonia, you immediately submitted a request to ORR for us to visit a shelter.
Yeah, so 3 days later, I got an email back saying that no media tours of any Southwest Key locations were available. I wrote back to them again, no response. I followed up multiple times with ORR and Southwest Key staffers to see if we could get access. Nothing. It became clear we were not going to be given access to one of these shelters. But we still had questions for Juan, so we asked if we could visit him in Austin, and he said yes.
But before we get into what happened when we went down to Austin and visited Juan Sanchez and the Southwest Key headquarters in Austin, it's important to understand some of the context and how the sheltering of migrant children works in general. So here we go.
When a minor arrives at the U.S.-Mexico border, first, a Customs and Border Patrol agent takes them to a processing center. That's where the viral images of children in cages, of children in those space blankets that look like aluminum foil, were taken. It's also where that really disturbing audio of a Border Patrol officer teasing children as they cry after they were separated from their parents was recorded.
Bueno, aquí tenemos una orquesta.
All of those were taken at a processing center run by Border Patrol.
By law, minors should stay there for a maximum of 72 hours. They're then taken from the processing center to a shelter overseen by ORR, which is the kind of facility that Juan operates. Minors stay at these shelters for an average of around 60 days until they can be reunited with a sponsor who's typically a parent, a family member, or a family friend. And then the child stays with that sponsor while they go through the process of seeking a legal pathway to stay in the United States.
Prior to 2012, the number of unaccompanied minors usually hovered around 6,000 to 8,000 a year. But then the number started to grow until 2014 when it skyrocketed. That year, about 50,000 minors were referred to ORR. President Obama called it, quote, an urgent humanitarian situation. Southwest Key's budget increased rapidly as the organization expanded to meet the need of housing many of these children. Then the number of minors coming dipped in 2015, leading Southwest Key to lay off many of its workers.
Southwest Key's employees were given the pink slip throughout the state, while some expected the layoff offer, others were caught off guard.
But then the numbers of unaccompanied minors started to go up again. And in 2017, after the Trump administration took office, ORR contracted with Southwest Key to build what would become the largest shelter in the country for immigrants who are minors. That's Casa Padre, the converted Walmart in Brownsville.
But starting this year, it wasn't just children coming on their own. There were also kids that had been taken from their parents at the border because of the zero tolerance policy.
And many of those kids, the ones separated from their parents at the border, ended up at one of Juan Sanchez's facilities. And so all of a sudden, all of the scrutiny comes onto Juan Sanchez and Southwest Key, especially after it became known that ORR had contracted Southwest Key for so much money. Southwest Key Programs has won around $1 billion in federal contracts since 2015. In 2016, Juan himself made over $1.5 million.
So we went to Austin to ask which narrative about Juan Sanchez is the right one. Is he a Chicano social justice leader, or is he a man who's profiting off of immigrant children? Stay with us, no te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Epstein Family Foundation in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tumana Memorial Fund, established to support NPR's international journalists, their coverage, and their commitment to providing the news of the world to audiences back home, and Heather Sturt-Haga and Paul G. Haga, working to ensure wildlife and wildlands thrive in modern Africa. Learn more at awf.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And when we left off, Antonia Cerejido and I were on our way down to Austin, Texas, to meet Juan Sanchez and speak to him directly.
Hi, good morning.
Do you like dogs?
No.
It was late July, and we were met at the door by Juan's very energetic dog.
And we were asked not to give any information about their home or their location. And that's because this family has been the subject of a lot of protests and even death threats.
Juan is 70 years old, and he lives with his wife, Jennifer, and their three young children.
So your name is?
Cesar.
And your name is?
Tenok.
Tenok. Can you tell me about your name?
It's the first Aztec king.
Antonia?
Yeah.
Those are some pretty radical Chicano names.
Yeah. Cesar after Cesar Chavez and Tenok after an Aztec king.
And their third son is named after Juan. And I asked little Juan what he wanted to do when he grew up.
I don't know. I just want to be known, kind of.
Ooh. Known for what?
Anything, really. Just something good, not something bad.
And good for you, like when you say I want to do something good, like what is that?
Like good for my community or just as long as I'm not hurting anyone to do it. Like my dad having a job that helps other people, anything like that.
We left Juan's house and we went to his office at the Southwest Key headquarters. In addition to the migrant shelters, Southwest Key continues to do juvenile justice work. They run after-school programs, summer camps, and even a charter school, East Austin College Prep.
Their headquarters, which are in East Austin, look like a large corporate office building. And inside Juan's office, there's a mosaic rendering of Martin Luther King Jr. There's a plaque of his doctoral degree from Harvard. And there's a poster with a quote from the revolutionary Che Guevara.
You know, this is one of my favorite sayings of Che Guevara, who said that at the risk of seeming ridiculous, the true revolutionary is guided by great feelings of love. And I'd like to think that that's who we are and what we try to do.
We sat down for our interview, and that's when Juan told us that several months ago he noticed that something was changing at the shelters that he was running for migrant children.
For the last year, we'd have a number of kids increasing on a regular basis. We're going anywhere from 25 to 50 kids. All of a sudden, you begin to see more, 75 to 100 kids a day coming in.
He said he actually first heard about the zero tolerance policy of separating children and parents on the news.
And so, you know, I talked to our staff and said, are we getting these unaccompanied minor kids that have been separated? And they said, yes, we are. And then the difference, too, was that there were smaller kids, many smaller kids.
Juan says he gathered his senior staff.
And so we had to make a decision. And in the end, we felt somebody's got to take care of these kids. And these, we don't take them. Somebody else is going to take them. Could be a private for-profit company that does it.
Juan and his team had to make a choice. Were they going to shelter these kids who were taken from their parents, or were they going to say no and as a result risk losing their contract with ORR that happens to make up 85% of their budget?
So we just geared up our staff to begin to serve a lot more younger kids. And I think we did a very good job, but people see you as this evil person for having done that. Very evil person for having taken these kids that have been separated from their families. And I think for some people, they just can't get over that, that's a decision that we made.
I asked Juan if he grasped the moral dilemma of that decision. The moral dilemma being, if I collaborate with the U.S. government in this policy, then I'm in one way or another implicated in the policy, as opposed to saying, I will have nothing to do with that.
I think that's the problem. And I think that it may be part of what I failed to realize in the beginning, right? But the decision wasn't that easy, right? Because the decision was really all that we've been doing for 20 years was going to end for us. And we're willing to end that.
The way he saw it, he either had to comply with the government or get out of the business of sheltering kids altogether. Despite his role in housing the children, Juan says that he is not in favor of the zero tolerance policy.
Well, I think everybody in this country has come to understand that this is not a good policy. It's terrible. It's traumatic for kids. It's just a very difficult policy to. It was a very difficult policy to create a lot of problems, and that's why it doesn't exist anymore. And my hope is that that's the way it's going to stay.
After the Trump administration ended the policy of breaking up families at the border, people continued to protest outside of the offices of Southwest Key.
Free the children now!
On the deadline day to end family separation, these activists are still aiming anger at Southwest Key over the federal operations.
And we're here to say to the city and the county, end your contracts, every penny of public money.
One of the people who protested outside of Southwest Key is Patty Quincy from the Texas chapter of the American Federation of Teachers.
When we are supporting an organization that benefits from child detention, then we're supporting child detention.
One of the most common criticisms about Juan is about his compensation. He was paid about $1.5 million in 2016. In a statement, the Southwest Key Board of Directors defended Juan's salary, saying that their, quote, executives are compensated in line with what executives earn across comparable nonprofits.
And I think that diversity is part of what makes us successful. The fact that we pay people well and take care of them makes us there. But there is this jealousy. People just cannot understand, why do you make so much money? It's incomprehensible to people.
In general, Juan's been confused by what he sees as a turn in public opinion on him. It was just 2 years ago that Republicans were angry that federal funding was going towards the shelters. But today, it's progressives like Patty who are the ones protesting outside Southwest Key headquarters.
Antonia and I left Austin feeling like we didn't have all of the answers. The way he justifies his salary and the line of his work is by talking about the quality of the care that he offers migrant children. But since ORR denied access to Juan's shelters, it's hard for us to testify to the quality of the care that he does provide.
But we did get the opportunity to speak with someone who toured Casa Padre, the converted Walmart. Jennifer Podkol from the Kids in Need of Defense Fund, an advocacy group, told us about her main concern.
Putting children in institutional-like settings and in facilities where they're holding hundreds of children.
She toured the shelter before the zero-tolerance policy was enacted and was concerned even then. She specifically finds the size of Casa Padre to be problematic.
We were dismayed when they opened the facility because it was so large. It was able to house over 1,000 children. And so we were very concerned about that kind of institutional-like setting, particularly at a time when kids were spending so long in these facilities.
Jennifer says that since zero tolerance was announced last year, there's been a huge backup in the system, which has meant that kids are spending much more time in the shelters than they used to. Today, the average is around 60 days, when it used to be 40 last year. Jennifer points out that although protesters have focused a lot of attention on the shelters, it's really the government that's responsible for family separation.
I think the ire at some points during all of this was a bit misdirected. So if DOJ and DHS hadn't put in place those policies, these kids would have never ended up. Many of these children would have never had to go to these facilities.
The zero tolerance policy has led to a lot more scrutiny on the shelter system. And since we interviewed Juan in Austin, more questions about Southwest Key have come up. And a quick warning to our listeners. In this next part, we're going to be talking about cases of child sex abuse. Recently, ProPublica broke a story detailing multiple incidents of sexual abuse at Southwest Key facilities, including details of how a Southwest Key employee repeatedly touched a minor's genitals in 2015.
The minor reported what happened to him, and the Southwest Key employee was arrested and later convicted on a count of molestation. He did not return to Southwest Key.
Given this report, we called Juan for a follow-up interview.
And when something like this happens, it's certainly very, very disturbing. I think that what I will say is that, you know, we adhere to very strict policies on abuse and neglect.
Juan told me that every staff member has to go through extensive fingerprinting and background checks. They undergo 80 hours of training, plus an additional 40 hours every year.
We educate every child from the very beginning when they come to our facility. and we inform them and we educate them and we train them regularly that they are to report anything that makes them uncomfortable in any way, shape, or form.
Since that last phone interview with Juan, another ProPublica article came out detailing more severe sexual abuse allegations than the previous article.
A youth care worker for Southwest Key was accused of molesting at least 8 boys and is charged with 11 sex offenses in one of the Arizona shelters between 2016 and 2017. The shelter in question was cited in 2017 for failing to complete background checks on employees to check for former sex offenses. Another man was arrested just this past July at another Arizona shelter on allegations that he sexually abused a 14-year-old girl by kissing her and rubbing her breast and crotch.
In a statement about the case of the 8 boys who were molested, Southwest Key said, quote, "Any employee accused of abuse is suspended and law enforcement called. This is what we did in this case." Southwest Key declined to comment, though, on the background check issue. One thing that these cases call into question is the scale of the organization, which is a sprawling system of 27 shelters across 3 states, housing thousands of kids. So how is it possible to assure a safe environment for minors when Southwest Key is overseeing such a high volume of children and workers? I asked Juan if there's a part of him that regrets building a space like Casa Padre, that converted Walmart that holds up to 1,500 kids.
Well, it's yes and no, Maria. I know that sounds odd, but no, in the sense that I think if we had to do it over, we might not have built anything that big, right? Because I didn't realize that it was going to be used as much as it has. On the other hand, it takes care of kids. And the more kids that we're able to serve and take care of, we think the better, right? Because ultimately, even though we get criticized for developing all these detention centers and mini prisons and all that, ultimately, what our goal is to reunify these children with their families. That's what we're about. That's what our mission is.
But Juan, you know, hold on a second. They're going to hear you saying, my goal is to reunite these kids. And they're going to say, pero Juan, actually, no, you are housing the kids. Like, what do you say to that critique where they're saying, no, Juan, you don't actually want to reunite them? Because if you did, you'd take all of your effort and put it into actually helping those reunifications happen by finding family members instead of sheltering these kids. Let somebody else do that.
I don't know that you understand what we do, Maria. As much time have we as
no,
we
no,
spend
I,
together.
I understand. I mean, I'm pushing back.
You know,
I'm pushing back.
Let me do. You got 50 to 100 kids coming in every day. What do you do with those kids? What would you do? 50 to 100 kids every day. What would you do with them? I'm asking you, since you're criticizing what we do, I'm asking
well,
you,
I'm being
what
a journalist.
Would you do? You have 50 to 100 kids that show up every single evening. What do you do with them?
What if I'm not in the business of sheltering kids, period, at all?
It's very easy to criticize us. Very easy. I mean, it's the easiest thing to do. But you tell me a practical, doable solution of what you would do if you had these kids.
What if somebody said, well, why don't you put them all into foster care so those kids are actually in a family? They're not in a shelter. They're with a family. And that your service would be to intake the kids, get them with foster families, and to provide the services that you do provide during the day, the schooling, the food, the no sé qué, pero que, that they sleep in a foster family because that's going to allow them to feel more family-like.
Well, a couple of things. One is the foster care system is not a great foster care system here in the state of Texas or Arizona or California. They are worse than even shelters are.
Okay.
And secondly, the federal government is not going to be funding this kind of work to be done at a foster care level. Now, there are some facilities, and we're looking at this ourselves, is the idea of developing foster care for some of these children that we cannot reunite with their families, have to stay longer, and those kids to keep them in a foster care facility. But that is not an answer, Maria. You have 150 to 100 kids in. Where are you going to put them a day? Where are you going to put these kids? How are you going to find foster care parents?
Juan is right that states in which his shelters are have foster care systems that are known to be problematic. In 2016, a Texas federal judge declared the state foster care system, quote, unconstitutionally broken after he heard of the conditions former foster care children had to endure. There are other migrant shelters that have taken a foster care approach. Cayuga Centers in New York has the kids during the day for activities and instruction, and then they go to a foster home at night. But Cayuga has had its troubles, too. A New York State oversight agency recorded 54 substantiated claims of abuse and neglect just in these past 5 years. How to properly care for tens of thousands of minors who have come into this country alone is a very complex question. Juan believes it's something he's uniquely qualified to do.
We did it with Clinton, we did it with Bush, we did it with Obama, and we've done it with Trump. And the work of dealing and working with these children, of bringing them, addressing them, providing all the services we do, and then reunifying them with their families, that hasn't changed with any of these four administrations.
But whether he sees it or not, the nature of his work is very different today than when he first started 20 years ago. For starters, he's making exponentially more money and housing way more kids in his shelters.
And the current administration he is working with has shown that it prioritizes immigration enforcement over the welfare of children and migrants, as we saw when they took away children from their parents at the border.
The zero tolerance policy might be over, but the people who created it are still in power, and Juan continues to work with them. In fact, he told the Southwest Key is in the process of renewing its contract with ORR.
The zero tolerance policy wasn't enough to make him break his relationship with the government. But the question is, given the way immigration policy's been going, when will Juan be faced with another moral dilemma? And if and when that happens, what will Juan do? Thank you, Antonia, for reporting this story with me. And since we last spoke with Juan Sanchez, there's been some news. Unidos U.S., formerly known as the National Council of La Raza, which is one of the largest advocacy organizations for Latinos in the United States. It's a membership organization, and Juan once served on the board. Unidos has officially announced that they have suspended their affiliation with Southwest Key programs. They say they've done this as a response to the sexual misconduct cases that have come to light. That's it for today. Latino USA is produced by Miguel Macias, Antonia Cerejido, Andres Caballero, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoka, and Sayer Quevedo, with help from Fernanda Chavarri. We're edited by Marlon Bishop and Sofia Paliza Carr. Our engineers are Gidi Montalvo and Stephanie LeBeau. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our fellows are Virginia Lora and Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Special thanks this week to Ian Colgren. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. And if you like the music that you heard, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on the next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. The Annie E. Casey Foundation creates a brighter future for the nation's children by strengthening families, building greater economic opportunity, and transforming communities. And the Marguerite Casey Foundation, change for families by families.
The moral dilemma. The dilemma. Moral dilemma.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And the Kauffman Foundation, working together with communities in education and entrepreneurship to create uncommon solutions and empower people to shape their lives and be more successful. More online at kauffman.org. This is NPR.